Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Damn It. I'm Jennifer Weigel, and joining me in the conversation today, very excited to have author, medium, and overall cool chick, Suzanne Northrup, who's been doing this for a very long time. Not too long, because you're not that old, for gosh sakes. But Suzanne, I would say you are a veteran in this space and highly respected, and we're very grateful to have you on the conversation.
Oh, why, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So for the listeners who are not familiar with Suzanne, and shame on you if you're not, her books, Second Chance, Healing Messages from the Afterlife, or Everything Happens for a Reason, might be familiar. There's also the Medium's Cookbook, which is Recipes for the Soul. She also had a series called The Afterlife, and I'm really interested in a lot of what you've been doing. But first, let's talk about how you got started with this. At the age of 5, is that correct, Suzanne? You started to know you were wired a little differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think 5 is an age that, you know, it's interesting enough because there has been some recent studies, believe it or not, in the last few years, which a lot of people don't even realize, is that the scientific community somewhere along the line has become either, you know, interested or, you know, for whatever reason, but they've now done studies where that they realize that children up until the age of 5 can't really what we call differentiate between this world and the other world. So I think that's kind of interesting because you've always heard the stories about, you know, your imaginary friends, which, of course, now we're learning that they really weren't imaginary, even in, like I said, the scientific community. So I think that that's kind of a real eye-opener from a long, long time ago. But I knew at a very young age that I was different. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think I knew what that really meant. And then what happened to me, you know, a little bit down the road when I was 13 years old, I lost my paternal grandmother, who was like, you know, kind of like the larger in life type grandmother in my family. Mm-hmm. And she had colon cancer. And so needless to say, it was a pretty awful thing for, mm-hmm. you know, for anybody to experience. And so she was in the hospital and I was sort of like kept from her, for lack of better words. And then I did go see her, and then when I saw her, this woman who, again, not only was larger in life, you know, energetically, but also was, you know, larger in life physically, she was like, you know, what we would say was like, you know, 175 pounds and then was down to like 80 when I saw her.
Sure.
And I can't tell you if it was the day of, the day after, or whatever, but when she made her transition, she came to me, and she did, you know, what I call my little Hollywood experience. She stood at the bottom of my bed, and she said, you know, I want to give you my piano and my favorite house and my ruby with a diamond in it, and I can't visit you often, but I want you to know I'm always going to be there. To me, the part that was probably the most very interesting thing is that she was big and fat again, and when I had seen her, you know, her big self again, and when I saw her the last time in the hospital, she, like, you know, was like 80 pounds. So there was this, obviously, this real physical thing, and I said, oh, grandma's well again, you know, everything will be, you know, somewhat, if there's such a thing as normal as being home.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my sort of first experience with somebody who was a living person that became a dead person.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, you know, reflect on this for, you know, for a lot of reasons. Obviously, that was, you know, when the actual that door of connecting with the other world opened up. But the other thing is that, you know, I always share this with people because I really truly believe that if everybody had this experience, we would all view death very differently. And I think anytime we have anything at a younger age, we're a little more impressionable. 13 is not, you know, exactly a fun age to begin with.
Sure.
But so I would say that, you know, that was sort of like hit me in the head. And I don't think that, you know, you, again, you know where to go with it. I mean, I didn't have a place to go with it,
mm-hmm.
Except for that I knew that my father was pretty flipped out and the house was sort of turned upside down. And to me, it was like, yeah, but grandma was really well. I mean, I saw her well again. So I'm trying to put this together in my head as a kid. And, you know, all these other, you know, obvious things that are happening around me are pretty radical.
And how did your family help you cope with that? Did they tell you to shut it down, or did they nurture it?
They didn't do kind of anything. what was interesting is that, you know, a few days after she passed, you know, we went to, you know, to the parlor, you know, tuna parlor,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and I'm sitting there, and my grandma was actually very well known. She was a very successful real estate broker in a time that women didn't do that, and so she had obviously, you know, it was very well attended, and I'm looking at this box. And I'm saying, like, who is this person, like, wearing my grandmother's clothes in this box? I mean, I kind of thought it was a, I thought it was strange. I thought the adults were strange for doing this. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, all of a sudden, I must have been, best as I can remember again, I must have been saying something out loud, because my mother sort of, like, you know, semi came running down to wherever I was and said, like, I think you need to go sit in the car.
Mm.
So whatever I was doing was obviously not acceptable.
A little unsettling, yeah.
A little unsettling. So I went and sat, of course, in my grandmother's car, because it was her car that we were driving. And then, you know, my father, you know, drove it, you know, 100 miles an hour through the one street town that I lived down on the way home. So there were, like I said, there was a sequence of these events that kind of were going on. And I'm, like, trying to put them in. But the thing is that it was that, you know, yeah, I don't think, you know, first of all, even in these days, there are certainly so much more out there. So parents, we hope, would be a little more receptive. And in this particular day, and, you know, I was just sort of, like, riding in the car and all this stuff was going on. And I think I realized that maybe I better not say anything, because they were already upset with telling me to go sit in the car. So I went and sat in my grandmother's car, and she came and sat with me. I mean, it was just like, so.
You're like, of course you are. How are you doing? Hey, Graham, how's it going?
Yeah. And so I kind of had to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think that in my particular case, because I had this so young, that by the time I, in reality, again, whatever that means, realized that I really was different, I mean, to the fact that I, you know, heard and saw dead people,
right.
I was already 19.
Right.
So it was like, it wasn't great for dates, you know. You go on dates and, you know, the dead person, the dead grandfather, whatever, shows up with it. Or
did you wonder who was your real friend for a while? I've talked to a lot of people who go through that. It's like, oh, do you like me, or do you just want to talk to your dead people? I mean, did you go through that at all?
I think I went through that much more professionally.
Sure, sure.
Because, again, this is, you know, I as I shared with you, you know, this is the only job I've ever had, so I've never really had another job. My background, actually, I have a master's in music and composition. I thought that's what I was going to do in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you have ideas, and obviously, you know, we plan, God laughs, so to speak.
But, right.
I would say that because I was an only child for a long time, for the first 9 years of my life, and then, you know, I had two sisters who came, and that's over a generation,
right?
And then I was raised in a rural town.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of times, you know, outdoors, you know, in the fields and whatever, and that, I believe, that door was made very open to me.
Right.
I also, in a lot of ways, you know, after my grandmother passed, there was really a lot of trauma in the house.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, to be honest, I think I had access to the other world, and that became safe.
Sure.
This world was becoming not safe. And because I, you know, that door was, you know, available to me. And I do think that does happen, you know, and I'm sure this probably happens, to be honest with you, with a lot more younger people in our life than we realize. Now, I have a very, very good friend who runs the, you know, the psychiatric, you know, hospital, the biggest children's psychiatric ward in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we're really, really good friends. And we talk about this. And there's a line where I think younger people, they either can't deal. And, you know, there's trauma in their life. They've been, you know, whatever. They've been, you know, beat up by their parents or, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And they may really have mental problems, but I believe that there's probably a certain percentage of them that have mental problems because of the circumstances, and they're too sensitive to deal with it.
You know what? It's interesting you say that, because I've interviewed a lot of people who say that when they were children, in fact, Judith Orloff, her parents put her in an institution because she was so intuitive and saying these things, but then she was so stressed out and so empathetic, she was feeling everybody else's sludge. And I think a lot of these cases, and this is what you're saying, is they're empaths, and they're absorbing all this energy that's not theirs. Then they're highly intuitive. Then they're seeing dead people and hearing dead people. And some of it might be chemical, and yes, they're hearing voices and it goes in a dark place, but others might be really, really gifted, and their parents don't have the tools to understand it.
Not only the tools to understand it, but, you know, we're talking about something that, you know, depending on, you know, your culture, your beliefs, your background,
right,
taboo.
Sure.
If you're raised in a heavy religious family, it could be very taboo because they really can. And in her particular case, because, you know, I know Judith, you know,
yeah.
And she obviously came from shrinks. So, mm-hmm. You know.
MD, yeah, psychiatrists. So they were very medical family.
You know, they're going to immediately, you know, when you start seeing things that nobody else sees. And
right.
You could forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in my particular case, I was raised in this rural town. I was not raised in a religious family at all. As a matter of fact, I was the only one in my family who was interested in going to church because of my love for music.
Sure.
So I had that. And, you know, they weren't educated to the fact where we had like a lot of books around the house, you know? So I think those factors and the fact that, because I had spent so much time alone and I was obviously very comfortable in that,
mm-hmm.
that world was available to me, and I went to it, and I don't think that I shared whatever that I shouldn't have with my parents. Now, what's interesting is that my mother is unto herself actually pretty tuned in. She mm-hmm. would kind of always know where my father was and what he was doing, which was never any good. And, so, she would use words like, you know, she would certainly use the word, you know, in terms of God or, you know, but it wasn't kind of in a religious way.
Sure.
It was sort of like, you know, it was like, you know, the good Lord knows these things or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, my mother, I think in her own right is pretty psychic. So I think that a combination of all of these things made me, like I say, have access to the other world without a taboo. Now, I've obviously, since you've interviewed a lot of people, I am sure you've heard some pretty intense stories. Because as professional and of colleagues of I've had them experience some pretty intense stories. Also, you know, I mean, I had one woman that I worked with. Actually, she was one of the ones that said I would do this professionally. She Kay had an experience where her father was a Baptist minister, and she would play with her little girlfriend out by the pond.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the little girlfriend that no one else saw, and then one day her father came and got her, and turned her upside down to shake the devil out of her, and then brought her to the podium
mm-hmm.
in his church again to do this in front of everybody so that they would see, you know, that she had the devil and he was going to get it out of her. And so she talks about the time of how she was leaving the church in tears because she thought, you know, her friend was going to be gone and that her father had chased her friend away. And she got down by the pond and her friend said, "No, I will always be there with you. I'll always love you."
Yeah.
Well, fast forward, and her life, you know, of course, until her father dies, she realizes that her mother finally shares with her that she had a twin sister who died at birth.
Oh.
So there you go.
So there you go. And that's the other thing, too. You know, your title, Everything Happens for a Reason. Having worked for so long in the news business where, you know, kids are murdered and there's death and, you know, someone's pushed out a window or, you know, burns in a terrible fire.
Right.
How can we help others understand that everything happens for a reason, even when it seems so tragic in the circumstances?
Well, you know, I think that's actually, Jennifer, a very good question. Obviously, I must have been asked this 40 million times mm-hmm. in my life. Is that, you know, you have to, first of all, you always have to take what I call big leaps of faith.
Right.
I mean, and it's as simple as that. And those big leaps of faith is you either believe that you live in this, what we call universe, or this universe connect, you know, to God. There's an order.
Mm-hmm.
There really is an order in this universe. I mean, we know that, you know, certain things happen because, you know, this planet does that or, you know, this happening relates to that. And we see that in our daily lives, but we also see that in terms of, you know, what happens sort of like around the world, you know, with nature and you know, people and whatever. And it's like I can tell you this, that every organization that exists that has to do with trauma from MAD
mm-hmm.
to AMBER happened out of somebody's tragedies.
Sure.
And it's sort of like it's like anything else. Like you take something of that event, and because I deal with tons and tons of people who lose children.
And you were very helpful and instrumental with the 9/11 and people coping after that, and you get this all the time.
Yes, and there's actually been three organizations, which I'm very proud to say, that were started by people who connected me. One was the American Society for Prevention of Suicide.
Mm-hmm.
The people that actually started that, they started that in New York, And what was kind of interesting about them starting in New York is that he was a psychiatrist, and he lost his, wasn't his only son, but it was his wife and his only son. And, you know, you can imagine being a psychiatrist and his son committing suicide was just, you know, horrendous to him. So they started this organization, and they must have started it 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was in New York, they knew a lot of well-known people. So at one point, you know, Gloria Vanderbilt was part of it, and
sure.
Jimmy Collins was part of it. And so they, and it's now nationwide because I was just in Louisiana working, you know, last year ago, and I had a few clients that came to me, and they were telling me that they were part of this organization. I go, like, is it this name? And they go, yeah. And I go, it was really quite touching because it made me feel, you know, that that somehow I was instrumental in at least people starting to do something that's so important, because we need to, you know, needless to say that the suicide is on the rise is an understatement. And what a lot of people don't even realize is that there was actually just a New York Times study out, which you might have caught,
mm-hmm.
that you do know what the major age now of suicide is?
Oh, no. Is it like 12?
It's 11 to 14 girls.
Oh, gosh.
11 to 14 girls.
Yep.
And you know what it's about.
Of course. It's bullying. Yeah. It's cyber. It's all that.
Right.
Yep.
There's nowhere to run.
Now,
you know, I mean, I think about this because it was difficult enough as it was for me, knowing I was different, in my own way being bullied as a child.
Right.
That I don't know how I would have dealt with that. We had nowhere to run.
Truly.
So you know, knowing you're already different, and knowing and the truth is that I didn't know that. I mean, I knew I was different, but I wasn't exactly sure why. You know, it wasn't like you don't put two and two together like you're talking to dead. You don't put that together when you're younger.
No,
you know, it's just they don't fit together.
No, and
think about it.
Yeah,
you know?
For anyone who's listening to this right now, if you have a child, especially a female girl between the ages of 11 and 14, be hyper vigilant about what's going on. I have a friend who lost a daughter to suicide because of a Facebook taunting, because she really thought it was the end of her world. Her world is so, they are very narcissistic in the sense that they think that everything that is in their immediate circumstances is all that matters. And that's not to say they're bad people. That's just their world. So if their world comes crumbling down and they think everyone is talking about them, you have to not turn the other cheek. You have to get there. And if your children are intuitive to boot, they are picking up on things that are going to happen before they happen. And it's overwhelming and anxiety ridden. And so now I wonder what your thoughts are on this, Suzanne, but people are medicating left and right just because they can't deal.
They can't deal.
And I think sometimes medication is necessary, but a lot of times it's just like taking a diet pill. People just want to stop the craving. You know what I mean?
Well, I think we've become a drug culture.
I think,
you know, it's like, you know, we'll put it under the rug and it's going to go away. And it's not.
Mm-mm.
I mean, the truth is it will not go away. And by not dealing in or pretend, I mean, that's why I have a tremendous respect for parents that are on it and get on it, and you know, and anybody that's an activist that's coming forth about it, and I know Ellen does some wonderful work. I mean, anybody who is really on the case now really needs to be, because this is these kids are raised in a very different world, and we know. I mean, I don't have to tell you, being a woman, mm-hmm. you know, girls can be really mean.
Ugh.
And
yeah.
really mean,
yep.
And everything, your social pressures are so intense as a young child developing. And then you have this nowhere to run, you know.
Right.
You go to your Twitter or your Facebook or your, because you can't function not being online. Just, mm-hmm. You really have nowhere to go with it.
Right.
So it's pretty intense. And like I said, needless to say, I've dealt with more than I would like to.
So how do you help those that are still on the living side, right? What you've learned from those on the other side that have talked through those messages, is it meditation? Is it reflexology? Is it massage? Is it all of the above? Is it diet? I mean, what would you recommend to people that are here stuck with angst and intuition and nowhere to run? How do they make this make sense?
Well, there are probably a lot of different things that one can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think, and this sort of may sound like a cliche sort of word, but see, I believe everything is based in love.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow through love, and whatever that means, whether that means getting help,
mm-hmm.
if that means sitting around with the family, whatever that means, and this difficult world where I know two parents have to work, and you know, to support. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on, mm-hmm. but you know, I think it's like really important to utilize the summer, to utilize the holidays, unplug, get together. Do what we did growing up. You play games, you mm-hmm. interact, you have more of a connection, and this way you kind of like know what's sort of like going on, because there's not a child in the world that doesn't want to be loved.
Right.
And if you are, and as the parent, you know, your responsibility is to do the best that you can mm-hmm. to be on these issues.
Right.
And that means, if that means you have to monitor at home, because mm-hmm. you can't do that now.
Right.
And you got to like be somewhat tuned into your child.
Right.
When you start seeing behavior that you know is not their behavior, then you got to get on it.
Right.
You got to sit down with them, and you've got to get on it.
I have to tell you, my 10-year-old, he's only 10, but he's very intuitive, right? He's mm-hmm. been able to see my father since he was 2. Mm-hmm. But he is also extremely sensitive, and if the other kids don't like him, he freaks out. And so
right.
we were at a family event, and one of my cousins, you know, is a football player and, you know, just a very big guy. And, oh, my gosh, my son followed him around like a puppy. Just couldn't, you know, just, wow, he's so impressed with this mm-hmm. cousin and family. And because my son's an only child, so it was exciting mm-hmm. for him to feel like he bonded with
right.
a family member.
A lot of times cousins will feel like siblings too.
Totally. And so yeah. we're sitting there talking, and what comes up is my job. And that, well, it used to be something that my son was like, oh, my mom works for, you know, CBS or the Chicago Tribune. Well, now my mom interviews mediums and authors and stuff. You know, I mean, it's just not, doesn't have the same roll off the tongue as it used
right,
to.
Right.
So
right.
it comes up, and this cousin looks at me and he says, you actually believe in that crap? And, you know, it was like it took everything down to this low vibration sludge kind of zone. And so then afterwards, the cousin and my son didn't want to, you know, join us in the car and didn't want to be part of the unit that we were.
Right.
It was pretty obvious. And my son looked at me and he's like, Mom, no offense, but your job is ruining my life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh,
yeah.
gosh.
Right.
But then I said, honey, it's not that it's ruining your life. It's just that it's bringing up fears in some people who don't understand it.
Right.
And that's, you know, when you say everything comes from love, fear is the exact opposite of love. It's a lack of love.
It's a lack of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the thing is that what you did mm-hmm. is what everybody should do in the circumstances, is that you didn't poo-poo it. You didn't not talk about it. You didn't, you know, you embraced his fears.
Yep.
And, you know, it's like in life what he's going to learn, and just for the record here, I mean, you probably know this, but I'm going to give you, you know, some tips if you don't, is that something happens to boys between the age of like 9, 10, right around that stage,
mm-hmm.
that something happens. And I'm invariably have dealt with some real changes at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
But boys that are sensitive, the reality is that they do much, they have it much more difficult in this world,
mm-hmm.
period. I mean, girls can do that, get away with that stuff much more. Boys, we are, you know, our you know, macho culture and all the stuff that's connected to it is really, you know, dangerous to the sensitive kids, particularly sensitive boys.
Right.
And they do have a hard time with it. And I've dealt with a lot of parents that do that. So that's part of knowing your son.
Mm-hmm.
And part of, you know, that the sensitivity that he has. And it's sort of like, you can embrace it, but you can embrace it in a way where it doesn't become like so much of an ego thing, but it's just sort of like we're all really different, you know, and
right.
some people believe and some people don't. And I would certainly say to him, but you believe because you've talked to your grandpa,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you know.
Well, now he says that he doesn't and it never happened and that I'm not remembering correctly. He's now really trying to put it in a closet that he doesn't want to open.
Right.
And that makes me sad because it's
yes.
only been the last year. And, you know, it's just unfortunate because he used to be really open about it. And now it's like, no, this is weird. And I just don't want to go there. So we'll just see if it circles back again. I can only hope.
Right. But in the meantime, respect his wishes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't say to not talk about it a lot. You know, I would, you know, maybe try to just, you know, sort of like throw things down until he comes, you know, to that point.
Sure.
You might, even though he's sort of in the the denial stage. I mean, I don't know if you have other friends that have had this experience with their children, or that they are tuned in and their children are tuned in. It might be great if there was another, you know, boy or something of his age.
Right.
That, you know, that sort of experience. But, you know, if that's not to happen, you just be there for him,
mm-hmm.
be an ear for him. And, you'll just let them know. Like, people always have different belief systems.
Right.
And you may not remember now, but, you know, you may not remember again. But if you do, you know, you just kind of, like, hold that. And sometimes in life, you know, we learn how to share and not to share in the way, that we can. Like, it's important to share if you see another, you know, person like you or another younger person that's being, you know, made fun of. Then it's important to share.
Right.
That's
right.
Important to step up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but sometimes you'll people in lives, you know, have different beliefs. And you know that even within my family, because of my cousin, that was his experience.
Right. Right.
And sometimes it takes an experience for somebody to step, you know, over that line.
Right.
So,
and that's the experiential evidence. I'm sure you encounter this all the time in your work, Suzanne, is that people might be on the fence, or they come to an event because somebody bought them a ticket, and then boom,
right.
Their dead brother comes through, or
yeah.
child or dog or whatever it might be. And when you're getting these messages for people, I know you're clairvoyant, you see, but are you also clairaudient and clairsentient?
I'm clairaudient and clairvoyant.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
Most people are, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you hear things.
Music, so it would make sense that my audio would be, you know.
Of course.
The strongest, and that's why, you know, I'll get names and things like that. Because, you know, because we, when we think about how we've learned to learn language.
Right.
You know, obviously, you know, through different words and different sounds phonetically. So.
Okay. So when you were tested, I want to talk about a little bit with how you were tested through science, because, of course, a lot of people are starting to bridge this gap, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, there is a gap.
Yes.
And this was
that's
what...
It's become quite wonderful, because I've seen a radical change, because there was a time that, you know, the science and doctor folks didn't want too much of a part of me. Now they kind of like flock to be on my show and talk about me and be involved in the conferences that I'm in. And so that has really made a radical change. And, of course, you have some very well-known people, you know, between Evan Alexander and,
sure.
and you know, and Mary Smith that you know, have had these experiences. And, of course, you know, when it comes to, you know, doctors and scientists, it, you know, we kind of view it sort of a whole different way. But what happened in 1999, I was approached by HBO.
Mm-hmm.
That they were doing a documentary called Life After Life.
Right.
And, you know, anything in life, you always, of course, learn later on that, you know, it was Linda Ellerbee's company, Lucky Duck. And they were actually going, part of the documentary, besides, they had a lot of scientists in the documentary, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to be one of them, and quite a few other people, but... was to expose mediums as fraud.
Right, which is why I wrote my first book. Honest to goodness, Suzanne, I'll be honest. I wrote my first book, Stay Tuned, because I thought it was my duty as a journalist to expose the frauds in the psychic world and the medium world. And I walked away scratching my head with, well, I can't prove that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So I got contacted. And so what happened is that, you know, they when they were doing the documentary, they found that there was this... the scientist, this Dr. Gary Schwartz, lived in Tucson, Arizona, who was a tenured professor there, and that he was quite literally, we call, you know, doing these underground, he really had just begun doing these kind of underground studies of proving, you know, survival of consciousness after death.
Mm-hmm.
So, needless to say, they got a hold of this, and of course, doing this documentary, they go, no, this is important. We're going to expose them. Then this is one of the ways to expose them, but, you know, by having the scientist.
Sure.
So they said to him, listen, you know, if we can bring you, you know, four or five of the top mediums in the country, would you allow us, you know, to film them? And this way you get, you know, subjects for your studies. And,
sure.
And we get, you know, a documentary out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of like what happened. So I was contacted. John Edward was contacted. George Anderson and Gaiman. So there were five of us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what happened. So we were sent to Arizona in his lab, and then they had to have, of course, they had to have a subject matter. And what I'm learning about science is that everything, you know, how you prove things with science is you basically do it through experiments and data.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did is, you know, HBO needed to have a subject matter. But it's interesting because they were a little reluctant with Gary. Like, I don't know why they would thought he was going to, like, fudge the experiments. I don't know why. But they didn't sort of trust him. He didn't sort of trust them.
Right.
And as a journalist in filming, you would really understand the fact that all the original footage he still owns. He would never give it to HBO.
Of course. So, good for him.
And, you know, he gave them what they needed to put into the documentary, but he still owned the original footage.
Sure.
And he did it because he said, I don't want them to think blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So then they contacted a woman by the name of Judy Guggenheim. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she wrote a book called Hello from Heaven.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Okay. And so she had done a lot of ADCs, after-death communications.
Mm-hmm.
And so they contacted her because they figured she would know somebody that would be willing to be a subject matter for the documentary. And sure enough, you know, she narrowed it down to her Tucson people.
Sure.
And there's a woman, Patricia Price. Who had a lot of deaths in her family.
Right.
You know, she'd lost a son and her parents and, you know, brother, you know, like a lot of people.
But you had no idea who they were going to team you up with.
No.
Right.
No.
Okay.
No. We knew nothing.
Right.
And I like it that way, personally. I don't want to know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what happened. So not only did we not know anything, but I didn't even see her.
Mm-hmm. All right, you were separated, and then they put these funny caps on your head because I watched this clip.
What is that? What would happen is that when we sat around the room, we didn't know who the subject matter was going to be.
Right.
We were discussing it at the beginning of the. You know, by the way, you can download this documentary called Life After Life on YouTube now.
But yes.
Anyway,
yeah.
So what they did is they brought us in, and there was a screen where she was sitting,
mm-hmm.
and so we didn't know who was actually sort of sitting there. And they did. Yeah, that was the whole idea. That was actually John Edwards' idea. He's like, you know, he comes from the medical background. He thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we put these, you know, these EKG things to our head to see if actually anything's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And what was kind of interesting is that through one of them is that actually my head was going through her heart, which I thought was really interesting. So Gary's he's working at the computer while all this information is coming through. She's sitting on the other side of the screen, and we were only allowed yes and no. Basically,
right.
We would, you know, she would only say, we would say, you know, I see this person by this name and who they are, yada, yada, yada. And she'd say yes, and she'd say no, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the extent of her information. She would, then what all the information that I gave went into the computer.
Okay.
All the information that John went into the computer. All the information that George went into the computer. And that's how they figured the curves, the graphs, of the percentage. Now, there were five of us. You know, it's interesting because he used the analogy that you know, Tucson, if you don't know this, is a basketball town.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, okay, so who's considered to be one of the best basketball players ever? Well, it's Michael Jordan.
Right.
And so do we know what the percentage of hits are that he has in a game? And your take on that would be?
Right. Well, you say like 80-90%. I mean, he doesn't make every basket, but he makes a lot of them.
Right, but he mm-hmm. actually only makes 40%.
Oh, of course, of every shot, you have to take a lot of shots. Okay,
right.
got it.
So, but as a team, mm-hmm. they score in the 80 to 90 percentile.
Sure.
Okay, so we as a team scored in the 80 to 90% percentile.
Okay.
And obviously some of us scored higher and lower. I won't tell you who scored the highest because that would be bragging. But
it was you. I know it was you.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Okay, I do know that.
Yeah, he actually writes about it later on in his book. But
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in any case, so you put all that data into the machine, and that's how you come up with percentages.
Sure, sure.
And that's why you have to have, you know, a group of people doing it, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to figure the stats of however that works.
Right.
So anyway, I've done a lot of work with Gary ever since. You know, we've managed to, you know, he's forever trying to get me in his room with the wires. But in any case, so what was interesting for me about that is we ended up doing, over a period of about a year, actually John and I went back several times, and the subject stuff and the testing became more difficult. So they would go like double blind, triple blind,
mm-hmm.
One where we'd be in the room where they couldn't even talk. They would have to have a moderator speak. We couldn't see them. We didn't know if they were men, women, young, old, whatever it was. Again, all that data was put into there. So we ended up with about 33 people by the time we had done about over years of studies. What for me was really quite wonderful is, I was very reluctant to honestly first do this, but when I finally broke down to do it, I realized that on some level, scientists and mediums are very similar because we're both looking for the truth about something. We're trying to, you know, trying to validate, obviously, sort of information.
Right.
But out of all those 33 people, the people that got the most information, the most detailed information, were those that had the deepest losses.
Interesting.
They were generally people who lost children or, it's Tucson, so you had a lot of, elderly people and, college kids and, whatever.
Right.
And then, so the elderly people, might be a spouse who's passed or whatever.
Right.
And I found that was interesting because, I know that in terms of my work when somebody will, they'll say, like, I used to have more of a connection when my son when he died and I have less now, and does that happen? We go over that and discuss that.
Well, do you still see your grandma? I mean, it's been a long time. Do you think after a while they stop making visits? Is that what happened with you?
Well, they don't make it as often.
Okay.
There is a thing to time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not across the board. I think it really has to do with the relationship.
Sure.
But I was 13.
Mm-hmm. So right.
Quite a few years ago. I do occasionally have connections with her.
Mm-hmm.
I do occasionally have connections with my dad and my other grandmother. But I'll tell you who I have an ongoing connection with, my nephew.
Oh, I'm sorry you had a loss with that.
Yeah, that was hard. He was as close to a son as one could have, and he died in 2004.
How old was he?
He was 24.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. But he visits you.
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I always thought we would work together. Not that I thought it was going to be this way.
Right.
But I always know when, particularly if I'm going to have, it happens obviously constantly if I'm doing a group or I'm doing an audience or whatever it is. But if I'm doing a private, mm-hmm. he'll show up in the morning and mm-hmm. I'll know that there's going to be a child.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And usually, depending on the particular kind of passings,
yeah.
if they're intense passings, then he's always there early.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a really, really kind of an interesting deal.
Yeah.
So, but it's what with, he's been in many ways, interesting enough, a great teacher to me
mm-hmm.
because after his passing, he, he came to me like right away, like the same day.
Mm-hmm.
The same, it was like that night. But he said to me periodically that he wanted me to, and this is interesting because I like to share this with other people, that he wanted me to go to the place of where we had this great time together before while he was still here.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want me to go to the place of his childhood or why how he passed or any of that. He didn't want me to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that a lot in my sessions. Like they want us to remember when they were well. They want us to remember when we did these crazy things together, or we had this good time, or we went out to dinner, or we laughed. And it's like that's kind of where they want us to focus. And I mean, think about it; it really makes sense because
sure.
that's one, the place that they're in,
mm-hmm.
and two, they want to continue to be in that place with us. They want us to have that memory, not like that they were sick or how they
right.
passed or whatever, because they're not in that place anymore.
And do they tell you, in your experience with all the conversations you've had with the other side,
mm-hmm.
that they choose the body where they were the happiest, right? Like, well, I was a size 4 when I was 28 or whatever that is. Is that what happens for them? They go to their happiest body shape? And
Not generally with me. Now,
okay.
they may do that with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the reason that they do that mostly, Jennifer, is for validation.
Ah,
because
gotcha.
Remember, they got to validate they're coming through. So the way they're going to validate they're coming through is by letting you know information that only, that you couldn't possibly know about them. So remember that, that they're making a validation of their presence.
Sure.
And that's the most important part, my important part of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, you did say something earlier which is really kind of interesting, is my work really is about the living people. It's not about, those that have made the transition.
Right.
My work is about the people here.
And for the people here, you talk about recipes for the soul. What can people who are listening to this now, whether they're driving or running or working out, what can they start to do to open their radar to the positive energy? Because there's a double-edged sword here with opening yourself up, right? You could open yourself up to darkness and then you wind up, popping Xanax because you can't deal with the anxiety. So,
right. However, that should never happen.
Okay.
So, number one is that, to always avoid that, and to be honest with you, I've done this for a really long time, and I've taught for as long as I've been doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that few people have bad experiences. The only time we have bad experiences is if we do something we shouldn't be doing, like Ouija boards, things. things of that sort, you know, invoking people to come in.
Right.
That shouldn't be invoking people to come in.
Mm-hmm.
If you always put yourself in your center and you always keep yourself surrounded in light, you always say a prayer, you say only aloud, only with God's allowance,
mm-hmm.
may this person come through to me.
Period. Got it. Period.
It's like if you think about the basics of life, you know, it's like if you're walking in a neighborhood that you're uncomfortable about, you shouldn't be there.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And that's what the Ouija board does. And for anybody who has one, get rid of it now.
Yeah,
sorry if they're going to come sue me, but
no, but it's really true.
Yeah.
You know? It's interesting. When I wrote my first book in 1994, I wanted to write about that in my book, but, you know, they were a little afraid that Parker Brothers would sue them.
Right.
They wouldn't let me do it.
Right.
But what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know where Parker Brothers was originally, you know, where the company originally was?
No, what?
Salem, Massachusetts.
In Salem? Of course, right?
Of course. It makes sense, right?
Hey, apparently I was there, too.
There
weren't we all in Salem together? I'm sure that's why we're all friends now. So do you believe in reincarnation and past lives with all of the, you know, what you've been told from the other side? Do
yes.
we come back?
Yes. Thank God we got more than one lifetime to do it.
Right. Yes, we do.
And the thing is that even if you didn't believe in it,
mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, think about, you know, the people you might have in your life that at a very young age had talents
mm-hmm.
that they shouldn't have.
Right.
I mean, you think about it, you know?
Right.
I mean, there's some kids that just, you know, they're math wizards or they're, you know, they pick up a ball and, you know, they knew how to throw it. And, you know, it's kind of really interesting that, you know, that if you think about it, that how that comes about. But again, you know, I've always been of the philosophy is that this is what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to play in my sandbox with me and believe it, that's cool. But if you don't, that's okay, too.
Right.
Because I'm not here to, you know, to convince anybody of anything. Because I think the truth is, I don't think you can convince anybody.
No.
I think it's got to be in your experience. And that's what you're experiencing, you know, with the cousin. Is that, you know, immediately, you know, it's like he poo-pooed, you know, what. It was almost like he wasn't even poo-pooing, like you don't believe in that, but it was on some level, although we wouldn't go down that road, mm-hmm. it's kind of a disrespect to you, because if this has been your professional life and now is your professional life, it's like saying, okay, then his professional life is more important than yours or his, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, it's like in life, you don't have to agree with somebody's beliefs, but you got to respect them.
Well, and that's the thing. His mother had come to a show I did with Thomas John. And as you know, you work with Thomas John. And he freaks people out in the audience when he comes through with these very specific things. And so this cousin of mine's grandmother came through, and wow, was Thomas amazing with the evidence. And I sent that audio recording to his mother, and you know, his whole thing was, oh, it must have been made up. You probably told him everything that he said. Like, they literally thought I had planted Thomas with all of this information about my dead great aunt, which of course I didn't do. And, you know, people say, I get that a lot. Do you get people who are just having such a hard time embracing the healing and the possibility that they go right to skeptic zone because they can't hold the vibration of the healing?
I am probably not a good person to ask that question, only because I have done this for so long.
Right.
And I did this at a time no one else was doing it.
Right.
And what was interesting is that, you know, I might have been met with skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't done mostly. I mean, I do know, you know, I mean, I know George Anderson had, you know, he really was kind of burnt by Fox TV. And I had done, you know, TV. I didn't do as much TV as he did. I did a lot more radio.
Mm-hmm.
And probably because I did so much more radio, when I would walk into a studio, first of all, these were callers.
Right. You can't research a caller. Right. Sure.
So I couldn't even see them. So mm-hmm. you know, who knew how they were, unless they actually, you know, were setting up somebody to, you know, to trick me or whatever it was.
Sure.
It was, you know, I mean, I remember I did Maddie Siegel's show. I don't know, you know, probably don't know Maddie Siegel. Maddie Siegel's like, he's like the icon, one of the icon, you know, DJs of this day and era. He's
mm-hmm.
like in the 60s now. And
yeah.
Anyway, so he owns Boston. I mean, he owns Boston.
Right.
And he said on the air, I mean, you know, we have this on recording, I will put my FCC license on the line if this woman knew anything.
Right.
So, you know, I think that you, once it's like the proof is in the pudding, meaning that once you're able to do what you do,
mm-hmm.
and people can sort of question it, and he'd always say to me, he said, like, you know, you look like this kind of like this normal person, but you do this kind of wacky thing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I think because Thomas is younger than I am,
mm-hmm.
I think that there has, I'm going to use the word unfortunately, because of now of some of the people that are on television.
Sure.
That, and some of these people are paid.
Mm-hmm.
It puts it in a kind of a whole different light of respectability.
Right.
I've worked very hard to try to bring respectability to a very difficult profession.
Right.
And, and I don't have to tell you that the television, you know, has not been kind, at least on some kind of a level of respectability and ethics. Like, you know, if you watched Edward's show,
mm-hmm.
People went into the theater because they went into the theater to get messages, period.
Right.
It was structured specifically for that.
Right.
He didn't walk up to people on the streets and give them messages.
Right. He wasn't walking in a deli. And that's the other thing people need to know, is that these shows that are out there, a lot of times they're filming for 40 hours to get,
yeah,
30 good minutes. And I had Maureen Hancock on the show, and she said that, you know, she had the Psychic Next Door show, and they wanted to renew her, and she said absolutely not, because the producers wanted to create drama and fighting within her family.
Yes, exactly.
So she said, forget it, I'm not going to make up fights just so you guys have, quote, good TV. I mean, one of her clients was engaged, and they wanted her to fight with her fiance because the mom...
they wanted to do Jerry Springer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's what... The struggle is that, you know, and unfortunately, Thomas said this, he said that he's finding a lot of catty people within the industry, not from people like you, but there's some jealousy out there that he said, unfortunately, it's like worse than the drag queen world. They're so jealous.
it's
not good.
But, you know, that really has something that's been going on. That's been on for a long time. When I started my practice, I learned very, very, very at the beginning to watch my back.
Right.
Because if I was getting attention or I was getting more readings in there, whatever, then, you know, they would sort of throw daggers at me. And so that was a long time ago. Now with the advent of television, and, you know, it's really kind of blown out. Again, mm-hmm. I don't get a lot of that.
Nice.
And I think, you know, I mean, on some level or on a lot of levels, I guess, in some ways I feel actually quite blessed that I was a pioneer,
mm-hmm.
that I could do this at the beginning before it became a big thing on television, became, you know, all of these, you know, other things going on. So I kind of avoided that.
Mm-hmm.
And my show was, my show, The Afterlife,
yep.
was filmed in Canada, and they had, like, no money. There was no money. So literally, it's probably the only television show that exists where there was no editing, because they had no money for editing.
Sure.
So they were all live shows.
Well, I love that, and I would recommend...
I actually did an entire season in 3 days.
Perfect. And for anyone listening, just go look on Suzanne Northrup's YouTube channel, and you can click and watch episode after episode. It's fascinating because it's unedited, and it's just you, raw, doing your thing.
It's raw, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's what I love.
Yeah, but, you know, to do that, you've got to either be really good at what you do, or a little crazy, or a lot of guts, because, you know, you're out there. There's no filter.
Right.
And, you know, but I would rather have the onus be on me,
mm-hmm.
than have you make me look like what I'm not. Like, don't make me look better than I am at that moment in time.
Right.
You know, there's no 100% of this. I mean, you know, I've scored in the high 90 percentile, which is pretty good. Pretty
absolutely.
Cool, you know. But,
yes.
You know I would always much rather. That's why if somebody, you know, challenges me and says no, I will be respectful to them, and I'll go to a certain point. Although I don't get it a lot, I have to be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
and I'll just say like, okay, listen, write it down. You can take a look and check it out. You know, you not only have to read people, but you have to read people.
Right.
Meaning that there are people that are highly, highly sensitive,
mm-hmm.
and extremely vulnerable, and you got to be a little more tender with them.
Right. Right.
You know, if somebody is just being an ass, then, you know, you could be a little tougher with them.
Yeah, pin their ears back.
Pin their ears back, you know. And I'm, you know, and I play with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I put people. I'm, you know, I make them laugh. You know, I put them at ease. for that reason, because it is a, you know, a difficult subject matter. So I try to make it as light and funny as I can, even in the intensities.
Absolutely.
So that's me is as important mm-hmm. as how the message is sort of like given, because some of these people you've experienced them. They are a mess.
Yeah. And so for all those who are listening now, what do you know for sure? What do you know for sure that happens when we die from the years of talking to those who are on the other side and who've experienced this?
Well, I know we don't die.
Mm-hmm. Right. There is no death, A.
And that whatever might have been going on with us, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's a long-term illness or a boom, we're gone, that no longer exists once we leave our body.
Got it.
And that it's you know, it's not the same, but it's like when people are in comas, mm-hmm. And people are in altered states, that's probably the closest to what you might feel is going to happen upon time of physical death.
Yep.
And that's why when somebody's in a coma, I tell people, talk to them, they hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Their brain is not working, but their consciousness, their soul is working. It's the same, it's just what you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So they hear you.
Right.
They absolutely hear you. And I've seen people come back out of comas, no lie, and change their wills.
Wow. I'm sure.
Yeah. I have seen them do it.
Yeah.
So I say, like, you know, be careful.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like Anita Morjani. She was in her coma and she could hear the doctors and the nurses all talking about her. Like, when's she going to die? This lady's a goner. You know,
yeah,
it's
right.
Like, hello. Your inner monologue is audible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right. So, you know, like I said, you know, it's again, it's like anything in life. It's like, you know, the more you know,
mm-hmm.
I do believe people that have, you know, ADCs or NDEs, as a rule, view death differently.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean we still don't have, you know, issues, because it's the number one fear.
Death, yeah. Hello.
It's still the number one fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that... you know, the questions that I'm often asking, you know, are they in pain? Are they okay? And I say, listen, you didn't stop loving them because they left their body, nor did they stop loving you. I mean, that's still the greatest force. That's
right.
The continuum,
mm-hmm.
you know. And if you can, and I know this is very hard, depending on, you know, the particular kind of passing,
mm-hmm.
but if you can get beyond your grief to some level and just trust it, they'll come to you, because their job is to come to you, because they know you're a mess and they want to help you, and that's how they help you. So they come to us in all these different ways.
Like what? Give me some examples of
the
signs.
Well, the number one is dreams.
Sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the number one is dreams, smelling, sensing them, feeling them.
Mm-hmm.
Music is a big one. You know, you hear this song all of a sudden out of the blue on the radio.
Right.
Or you're driving down and you happen to, it's the day of your mom's passing, and you're having a bad day and it's pouring rain outside, and you pull up along this car and you look on it and it's on the license plate is your mom's name.
Now, right, right.
That's a validation. You can disregard it, or you can say, like, wow, what are the coincidences of that happening? Especially if she had, like, you know, this, you know, different name or whatever.
Sure,
so,
sure.
You know, those are things that happen, and they happen a lot within the first year.
Yep.
That doesn't mean they don't happen continuously after that, but more first year, and then it's more like birthdays, passing time, holidays times,
mm-hmm.
all of those kind of times of the year. That's why this time of the year is just so off the charts,
right?
Because this is when people go back to that time of, you know, whom they're missing in their lives, the holidays.
Sure.
And you know, this could be for many people the first year that person's not at the table.
That's,
you know?
Right. So put out the flare to ask for those signs and signals, whether it's a song or their favorite bird,
yep.
or a license plate or somebody mentioning their name out of nowhere at the checkout counter.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
In fact, that happened to me. I was thinking about my dad, and then somebody looked at my license and said, hey, are you any relation to Tim Weigel? And it was like he had been gone for 12 years at that point. And it's not exactly. So it was just right when I was thinking about him for the checkout person to say that.
Right.
You could say, sure, that's a coincidence, or you could just wink and nod and
yeah,
look up
exactly.
and say thanks.
Yeah, and you know that those are the little things that are the big things.
Yeah.
Those little things are the big messages in the scan. And, you know, and again, you have to, you know, stretch,
mm-hmm.
go to the belief that, you know, we don't die and they didn't die, and that, you know, that they want us to know that, and they go to all kinds of extremes to do that for us.
Yeah.
Because they love us.
That's right.
And they know, you know, they know the program. They were here.
Right.
You know, so it's like, yeah, I got that. I,
And even if there was a grudge when they passed, they're not keeping score. There's no clipboard of X's and O's, right?
Scores of scores, that's Mm-mm. for sure.
No, the scorekeeping is done. We do that on this side. They don't do that on that side.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's good to note. So anyone out there that's still holding a grudge because somebody voted for Trump in your household, just let it go. Or whatever the disagreement might be, you have to still understand that on the other side, love is all that connects us. And so we have to get away from those disagreements that, you know, disjoint us.
Right. Yeah. So I want to ask you a question because mm-hmm. I'm going to interview for you for the moment.
Yes.
So obviously love is the big deal here, and you... You know, we're going down the path of one way here, obviously, mm-hmm. with the Tribune and all this and that. And then this sort of, like, hit you. Did you go down fighting, or did you embrace that, no, this is what my life's about now?
No, I've been fighting it for 15 years.
Oh, okay.
No, I dipped my toe in the pond first when my dad passed away 15 years ago.
Got it.
I continued to do the interviews and the conversations. And then a year and a half ago, parted ways with the Chicago Tribune. And now being a full just me employee doing these kind of stories, I am now completely with both feet in this pond. And it's been a little... it's been very scary because of moments like I expressed with my cousin going, you believe in this crap? And what I say is that I'm asking the questions and continuing the conversation, and I'm not telling anyone what to believe. I'm just presenting the evidence so that they can believe whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where I continue to come from that space. But it's been very difficult. A lot of my journalistic friends think I've totally lost my mind. And I'm, you know, hitting the woo-woo train to crazy town. And that's fine. They can think that. But I know these conversations are important because we're in a very critical time right now.
Yes, we
are. Have to start expanding our minds or we are doomed.
Yes. No, we do. We do. We have to start thinking a lot more out of the box.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we also have to, you know, like as I was saying to you, you know, there is an order in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is within the universe, and that universe, you know, it's like there are there's karmics with cultures. There's karmic with countries. There's mm-hmm. karmic with, you know, all of those things have, you know, karmic aspects to
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to you know, think a little more out of the box. And also, we really need to get back to being kinder to each other.
Yeah.
Because that's we've forgotten what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, I mean, I'm not getting into the politics thing, but, you know, America is a great country.
Right.
I mean, I've traveled all over the world. I'm sure you have too. It's like, mm-hmm. It's a great country. I mean, I have a really close friend who went down to the Olympics in Rio,
mm-hmm.
and as a makeup artist was down there, you know, taking care of all the people. And she just said, "Oh my God, you know, it's a tough country.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of poverty, and it's a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have like clean drinking water. They, you know, we turn on faucets. We don't think about it.
Right.
So, you know, it's like." It's like everything in life has to do with a level, you know. It's sort of like you can, you know, there's the person that you feel sad because they don't have shoes, but then there's the person that doesn't have feet, you know.
Right. Oh, there's always something. I was feeling sorry for myself yesterday about something, and then I got a text from a friend who broke their wrist and their finger falling down the stairs trying to do laundry. You know, you got to always do that.
So when you can get outside of yourself.
Right.
And it's sort of like, you know, I mean, you know, besides a lot of the obvious things, you know, I happen to love this time of the year because I think that, you know, it is my hope anyway, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I just came out my newsletter and wrote about it, you know, yesterday, but it is my hope that we really embrace what this month is about, and it really is about giving, and it is about, you know, seeing the woman, you know, who's very elderly going across the road and...
Mm-hmm.
And she needs help with her groceries, and it's like, what's the big deal to help her? Or she's struggling with the groceries and the, you know, the thing that she's, you know, pushing at the same time.
Yeah.
At the car, you know, and so what is the big deal? You know, people they always talk about, and I'm sure they'd probably like, you know, mention certain things about Chicago, but you know, New York is an amazing city. When the entire lights went out in the town, I was about 5 or 6 years. I mean, literally, it was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who walked to 90 floors to help people up there that they knew had no way of getting out, or had no water, or had no food. You know,
right?
So it's like that's And that's what we do in this country. I'm sure you were raised that way. That's how I was raised.
Right.
And if I was raised that way, that means you're raising your son that way.
Yep.
So, that is what makes we do help everybody in the world in this country, and that is really true. And I never want people to forget that is the roots and the score and why we incarnated here for this particular sort of time. So, yeah, the whole world needs a little more of kindness, but I think in general, truth be told, most people in the world, I think, are basically good people. And we all really want the same thing. We all want love. We want to be able to take care of our families. We all want to be able to have a roof over whatever that may mean.
That's right.
You can see some of the poorest people that live really happy lives because they have family around them and children around them, and they're able to, to come home, and even if they work 14 days, hour days, pulling a shawl. Mm-hmm. And they're happy because that family makes them really happy.
Absolutely.
So, I think that we, in some ways, I've always believed that every child in America should go to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer of that.
Yep.
So we need to get back down to some of the things that are really, really important.
Get back
and
to the basics.
That when we talked about, the bullying thing and the love thing and just deal with it because,
right.
This is the people that are going to, they're going to say, going to inherit the earth when we're not here. And, that is our job, to do the best that we can to pass that on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was an old guru expression, he was sitting in the monastery one day and he goes, I'm going to go out and help the world here because, I've learned all these things through my meditation and stuff. So, he goes into the town and he spends a whole day there and he tries to, get everybody tuned in to, God and stuff. And then he goes home back to the place and he's exhausted. And he goes, maybe I should just start with just a simple thing. So then he goes back to and he tries to work with a family or a small town or whatever. Anyway, he does this about 5 times, and then finally he comes back one day and he goes, I just need to work on me because if I work on me, I'm going to radiate that energy.
Right.
I'm going to send that energy out just by being who I am.
Right.
Just by sending those thoughts. Sending, that energy of love.
Mm-hmm. And that's something we can all do right now in our car or in our workplace or in our family at home is radiate that heart. Suzanne Northrup is Suzanne with 1Z, 1N, Suzanne Northrup, Northrup.com. Find out more about her books, her YouTube channel, her event schedule. And Suzanne, thank you so much for, sharing your wisdom and doing what you do for all these years. Keep doing it for decades more so we are better for it.
Thank you. And you really are, I really thank you so much for having me on your show. You are a fine journalist and you are a fine interviewer. And not everybody can do that. That's an art too.
Well, thank you. All right. There's kudos from this side that I'll keep doing this on this side to help people connect to that side. How about
Yes. And like I say, the fact that you sort of like, I think, I know we're ending, but I think once we step into things,
mm-hmm.
I think it's really hard to step out when you know you're supposed to be in it.
Oh, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. That's for sure.
You got it.
All right.
I like that expression. That's a good one.
All right, Suzanne. We'll talk soon. Keep doing what you're doing and spread the love.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll talk soon. And everybody out there, spread the love as well. I'm Jen Weigel, jenweigel.com, suzannenorthrup.com. Thanks for joining the conversation.